Are you a fan of the independent film news and interviews on The Film Show? Well, you won't want to miss the new and expanded Words and Pictures, coming in 2019. That's right, The Film Show and Words and Pictures are coming together to fill the airwaves with the most creative...
Podría con solo pensar que los quería mover. Así podría... Unos ojos reales de animal... Unos ojos reales de animal muerto que de algún...
Welcome to Words and Pictures, the show about the narrative arts. I'm your host, S.W. Conser, and today's show is all about international film and animation. We have two amazing documentarians joining us. Irene Taylor Brodsky is the director of Moonlight Sonata, Deafness in Three Movements, which played to great acclaim at the Sundance Film Festival. Irene, great to have you back in the studio.
Thanks so much.
And fresh from the Academy Awards down in L.A., where his film Lifeboat was up for a Best Documentary, a Short Subject Oscar, Skye Fitzgerald is here. Welcome, Skye.
I'm happy to be here. Thanks.
Yes, and... Well, we are, and just in case there's not enough talent in the room, Rose Bond is here from the Pacific Northwest College of Art. Rose is gearing up to welcome a touring festival of experimental animation by Latin American women that's going to be curated by Lena X. Aguirre. Rose, always a pleasure to see you.
Good to see you.
Well, let's start with Irene and Skye. Your documentaries are part of the 42nd Annual Portland International Film Festival, PIFF. 42. It's about to get underway at multiple venues, including the Northwest Film Center. And so, yes, the Portland International Film Festival is a venue for showcasing not just visiting directors, but local filmmakers as well. Where, you know, although you're certainly globetrotters, both of you. So, Irene, I want to start with your film, Moonlight Sonata. Is this a companion piece of sorts to your first feature documentary, which was Here and Now? It was about your parents who were hearing impaired.
Moonlight Sonata is what I'd call a spiritual sequel to a film I made about 12 years ago called Here and Now about my deaf mother and father. That film was a memoir, and this film, the memoir continues because it turned out that right after I made that film, I had my first child, and that child was going deaf. Mm. So the film, I would say, is somewhat of a tone poem on the deaf experience and really looks at 100 years of the deaf experience and how technology has impacted the way we all connect and relate to one another. And also, you could say it tackles 300 years because Beethoven is also one of the protagonists. The film focuses on my 11-year-old son learning Beethoven's Moonlight Sonata on the piano. And Beethoven actually wrote that piece as he was going deaf and coming out of a watershed depression. So he really sprinkles the fairy dust in the film, and we do have animation in the film to depict Beethoven's inner life.
Yes. The animation is a big part of that. And How is it to be a documentary? Obviously, you're working with audio a lot. The audio, as many people have said, is really half of the cinematic experience. And when you're working with the deaf community, with the hearing impaired community, this is something obviously that you have to work around when you're working with your subjects, the subjects of your films.
There are a couple of scenes where there's some silent conversation going mm-hmm. on. I think maybe that's what you're mm-hmm. alluding to. And we let them play silent. We do have a beautiful score by Dylan Stark and Ben Johnson, both of whom are here in Portland. But we really tried to restrain the score in moments of silent ASL conversation, just to remind our viewers that the whole experience of sound includes silence. And so we wanted to give silence a fair shake in the film as well.
So you've gone back and forth between films that are really personal, really family oriented, and films that are larger subjects. Beware the Slender Man was a huge hit a couple of years ago. So coming back to a personal subject, does that ever? How do you get that that line between being invasive of the private life of your family and making something that's important and revealing to the outside world about the subject that you're working with?
You know, just as I don't really consider myself an issue-based filmmaker, I find myself just drawn to certain people. I'm very character-driven. And so I think in the case of the family pieces, these were never pieces or films that I wanted to tell. They sort of grabbed me and they said, you have to tell my story. So it's sort of that inner voice. I'm not a religious person, but I do have that voice inside of me that says, this film has to be made. You know, and so the two family films were really more that calling. And it's really a vocation to be able to do the memoir form, because it's rather excruciating, because you just never want to stop doing your best, because you're making a story about the people who are your world, really. I mean, in my family, that's my family. So
yeah. And what's the future for Moonlight Sonata? It's HBO has picked it up, right? But you've got plenty of screenings in the meantime. Of course, Portland International Film Festival coming up in a week or so. It's already got a future to it.
Well, it's going to be on the festival circuit this spring, playing around the country. It'll be having its international premiere this spring, and we are really trying to leverage a lot of existing U.S. law around accessibility in movie theaters, and really trying to help festivals create a more accessible experience for deaf and blind people. And so I actually need to applaud PIFF, because Portland has done so much to make this film accessible to deaf and hard of hearing audiences. And I think that's not always an easy thing. It's an era of voluntary compliance, and PIFF has done more than most festivals we've worked with at all. And for a festival of its size, I think it's really saying something about our city.
Now, some of the accommodations, of course, there's sign interpreters, there's subtitles, there are Wi-Fi-enabled devices. What other sorts of accommodations are being made these days?
Well, sometimes deaf communities request open caption screenings, and we are looking at doing some of those where you just have all of the dialogue and all of the audio description of things that are happening in the film up on the screen. So while that may not be the ideal cinematic experience for a hearing person, if you have enough of a sizable deaf audience that requests that, we are trying to encourage small theaters, independent theaters, to have those screenings. I know up in Camas, once a week, every Thursday, there are open caption screenings, mostly of second run commercial films, but those have a huge showing. They have a huge turnout. So.
Wow. Well, I want to switch over right now to Skye Fitzgerald. So congratulations. You just got back from, you were in the Dolby Theater. It was quite an experience being part of the short subject documentary crowd that were up for Academy Awards. And let's talk a little bit about Lifeboat. Obviously, this has been really well received. It's won numerous awards. And let's start by talking a bit about the film. How did you... It was sort of a long road to make this film.
Yeah, so actually, Lifeboat is the second in a trilogy of films that I'm doing that we're calling the Refugee Trilogy. The first film is called 50 Feet from Syria that we did 3 years ago. And that film we shot on the border between Syria and Turkey, where we followed an orthopedic surgeon from Lake Oswego, actually, who is Syrian-American, who went back to operate on refugees flowing across the border from Syria into Turkey. And on the tail end of that film, we had NGO workers, we had doctors, we had pretty much anyone who was working in the area tell us that as soon as the EU shut down the border from Greece, because there's a humanitarian corridor, of course, going into Greece from the Syrian conflict, that humanitarian corridor would have to shift westward. And that most likely it would shift into the central Mediterranean. And so when we started researching that, we discovered pretty quickly that there was a very high mortality rate on this particular point of crossing, leaving from the fractured nation state of Libya across the Mediterranean to either Lampedusa or the southern toe of Italy. And we did due diligence, started researching it more deeply. And when we learned that there were these small civil society interventions of small NGOs who had bought vessels and were simply motoring down to the area to pull people out of the ocean when the EU nation states weren't doing it, we were inspired by that and decided that was the second in the trilogy.
Now, you focus on a crew of German NGO folks who are assisting folks from Libya. This is refugees from North Africa from the civil war in Libya. And so how did the – obviously the Germans have been really active in welcoming refugees. Angela Merkel has made it a point to welcome a million Syrian refugees into the country and has taken a lot of heat for that. How did the Germans get active in that, and what point of departure? Because obviously they're not a Mediterranean country. Were they operating out of, and who are they partnering with?
So the EU response in general to the crisis, the asylum seeker crisis in Europe, has been evolving over the years, as it always has, and it's taken a turn for the worse in the last 2 years since we shot the film, actually. So Germany has, you know, if you know your history, since World War II, they've really have a very interesting, you know, asylum seeker process, and they are much more open to asylum seekers than many EU countries because of their history. And so the politics eternally within the EU, when we filmed, were very positive for asylum seekers. So the demographics that you described were partially accurate. So there were, when we filmed, about 30% of the folk who were pulled from the ocean, the asylum seekers, were actually displaced by the Syrian conflict, and they'd made their way overland to Cairo. They'd flown to Cairo and then made their way overland from Cairo to Libya because there was an open border. And then there were the other sort of 70% or so who were fleeing conscription in East Africa, who were fleeing war in Libya. And then there were, you know, what some people call economic migrants, who were also moving from their country of origin because they were willing to take this, you know, mortal risk of dying at sea rather than trying to raise a family on $1.50 a day for the next 10 years.
And it is a dangerous crossing. I mean, it's an incredibly dangerous crossing. There have been thousands of drownings. And this is an exciting film. I don't want to give too much away here, but this is an action-packed film, and there is a lot of action and tragedy. And again, not giving too much away. But you obviously, I mean, you got in there close. Did you have, were you in danger of not only of, you know, possible problems with storms in the Mediterranean, but also legal issues that you had to deal with or dealing with maybe hostile countries or what were some of the roadblocks that you had to get past?
So, you know, we embedded with a search and rescue operation, right? And so inherent in that is a certain level of risk, certainly, because it's a true triage situation and the stakes are life and death. But, you know, the risk that we were taking was nothing compared to those who are on the rafts, and that's what you sort of hold on to in moments like that. But
these are overburdened rafts. These are often inflatable rafts with dozens of people on them.
Yeah, they were. And you know, the area of operation, the search and rescue area off the coast of Libya, is sketchy at best for a number of reasons. To a great extent because of the Libyan Coast Guard. So our first mission, which we were supposed to embed in, actually was canceled because 2 days before we were going to fly out, the Libyan Coast Guard / some pirates boarded a sister vessel run by MSF with small arms and shot it up. And the MSF crew fled to their safe room. And fortunately, they were well-trained, and they couldn't get into the safe room, and no one was kidnapped or killed. But that sort of made Sea Watch sit up in their cosmic chair and go, maybe we need a safe room. So they brought the boat back to harbor and built a safe room into the engine room so they could navigate the vessel from the engine room if they were boarded. So that sort of risk was real too, and the crew of our vessel had to sort of take that into consideration anytime we had a point of contact with the Libyan Coast Guard, because they were you know, they come from Libya, and it's a fractured nation state where there are two competing governments right now, and no one's really in control.
Now, you said that this is going to be the second film in a trilogy. So tell us about what's next for you and how you're going about it.
Yeah, it is the second in a trilogy. We're hoping to film the third, the tail end of 2019. it's again a film where we're sort of embedding into an unfolding tragedy and document it pretty intimately. I can't talk to the location at this point just because it's very delicate and access is very difficult, but we do intend to film at the end of this year.
And I think part of this, obviously, you started with this trilogy of films about, Syria, about Libya, before the immigration debate in the U.S. Turned ugly. I mean, as ugly as it's become lately. At this point, you're really what's the message that you're trying to get across to audiences, and with all of the access that you're getting, and all of the good press that you're getting, what's your hope for the films besides doing well and allowing you to keep doing art in the future?
Well, I there's a lot of resonance for what Irene said a little while ago about there's certain films you just need to do, and for me, someone asked me a couple of weeks ago, why are you a documentary filmmaker? Why do you do this work? Because it's not easy, right? It takes work and it takes effort, and every step has its perils of different kinds. But I don't think I can do anything else. I think this is kind of what I was built for and what I'm called to in a way. So. But I have to have a film call my name. It has to be sort of a gut instinctual reaction to a topic or a story or a person. And when that happens, I really can't say no to it. And so when I met the doctor from Lake Oswego for the first film, I had that reaction to him as a human being. And so it sort of transformed into this refugee trilogy based on our experience filming that project.
Well, I'd like to play a little clip from Lifeboat right now and give folks a sense of what they can expect when they go to the film festival. And check this out as part of the documentary Short Subjects coming up in March. So let's play a little clip.
We found another rubber boat, 012 degrees. Is there another one, Joe?
Yeah, they look big.
People are risking their lives to sail from North Africa to Europe.
It sank less than 10 miles off Libya.
Migrants were fleeing poverty and war.
Three shipwrecks in just 3 days.
Only a handful survived.
Jump, jump, stay on the boat! Stay on the boat!
Et quand j'ai su, j'ai dit non, il y a deux casseroles. La vie et la mort.
And that is a clip from Lifeboat, Sky Fitzgerald's documentary, which was nominated. Once again, congratulations, nominated for an Oscar for Best Documentary Short Subject. So these are both playing at the Portland International Film Festival. The festival runs from March 7th through the 21st. Our listeners can find a full calendar of screenings and events at nwfilm.org/festivals/PIFF42. And do you have the dates, Irene and Sky, for when people can come in and check out your films?
We have a daytime screening on Saturday, March 9th at noon. And we also have a Friday evening screening on March 8th at 6 p.m., both at the Art Museum.
And that's Moonlight Sonata, Deafness in Three Movements. Sky, how about Lifeboat?
Yeah, Lifeboat's going to play on Saturday, March 16th at 1:30. And I believe that's the only screening at PIFF, so that's the one opportunity to go and see it.
Well, Irene Taylor-Brodsky and Sky Fitzgerald, thanks again for joining us today. And stick around, because we're going to talk with Rose Bond for a little while. We want to find out about this screening of Latin American experimental animation by Latin American women. And Lena X. Aguirre is the curator. Rose, you've had her in town before. She's been making the rounds of venues all over the country and elsewhere. Tell us what we can expect.
Well, I don't know about you, but the first time I heard about Latin American experimental animation, I thought, what is that? I don't think I could name one experimental animator from Latin America. And the actual thing is there are a lot of people doing work. And Lena is part of the Moebius Animacion collective. And they have generously and put up the films on a website. So a lot of these films that you would be hard-pressed to find anywhere else, you can actually find on their website. But it's extraordinary to have one of the curators come to Portland and present these short films. So you're going to have stuff from Mexico, Chile, Colombia, Cuba, you know, all over here at PNCA on Tuesday, March 5th at 7 p.m. The screening's for free. What happened the first time that Lena came was she did a collection of films from Latin America, and they had put out a call. They're coming back now with a second curated one of women. So they put out a call to Latin American and Latina women who have made films between 2011 and 2017. They got over 88 films from 10 different countries. So what you're going to see on Tuesday is just a taste of the diversity that they found. And the work, I think you'll see, I mean, when we think of animation, we often think of entertainment and consumptive entertainment. And I think you're going to see in these films this really strong presence of human and social issues. And just as my my colleagues here are talking, you look at these films and you just think, that's an author behind that, who's making that film for a very, very specific and real reason. So the kind of topics that are covered might vary from poverty, immigration, sexual violence, but also friendship, love, hope, all that kind of stuff, and really addressed in through a myriad of different animation techniques. You know,
right, there's some stop motion. Oh, there's some
abstract. You know, in Portland, we're really into stop motion, right? Uh-huh. So you think about, what would stop motion be like in Chile? And when I see these films, when I saw the films last time, I thought of a couple of things. One, I thought how important materiality is.
Yeah, you can really feel the texture.
Yes, they're very textured. You were there, right, Conch? Mm-hmm. And it's that, and it's also... people in Portland are pretty sophisticated about animation. So you know the work of Jan Svankmajer.
Mm-hmm. The Czech
right?
animator.
Yeah, the Czech animator. And he had a quote, it's like, objects are the keepers of memories.
Oh, wow.
And when I look at a film like La Casa Triste by Sofia Carrillo, it's like she went to what we would call thrift shops, I guess, and picked up items. And those are her objects and her puppets. So it's got this kind of embedded feel of the past in it.
Very personal, yeah.
Yeah. So it's an extraordinary screening. I'm really looking forward to it. And to have Lena here and put the whole thing in context is really an incredible opportunity.
Tell us a little bit about the collective, the Moebius collective that Lena is a part of.
Yeah, Moebius has been working on disseminating and studying experimental animation in Latin America. What they found were there were people making experimental films, but they didn't know about each other.
Huh.
So you could be in Argentina or you could be in Colombia, and you wouldn't know who else was doing this. So they became this kind of nexus place and actually went around, visited did studio visits with animators, gained trust and whatnot. And they design these exhibitions that aren't just screenings, but are also opportunities to educate, to inform, and to promote this kind of work.
And maybe to make common cause as well, you know. I mean, artists, it seems to be harder and harder for artists to make a living in the digital age. But also at the same time, you have platforms where internationally you can really share stuff much more easily.
Definitely. And like I say, there, if you go to the Moebius Animacion, that's a C-I-O-N, .com, you're going to find a lot of these films. They're looking for translators. Right now it's in Spanish, but the work is there, and it's really incredible. So,
and this is going to be March 5th at 7 p.m. at the Pacific Northwest College of Art, right across from the Central Post Office in Northwest Portland.
Yeah, that's right.
And well, tell us a little bit more about, is this available on the, information available on the events page at pnca.edu?
I believe it is. It better be. Yeah, I don't, I'm not quite sure if we have that. I know we have it on our Instagram, and if it's on the PNCA, I should do that.
And how do people contact you or find out more about your work as well? Because you do a lot of important work. You are the head of the
Animated Arts.
Animated Arts Department at PNCA. Mm-hmm. So you have a lot of screenings. You work with ASIFA very closely, which is the Animation Society here in Portland.
Right. Yeah, it's really great to be located in Portland and to be in a place where we can have this broad view of what animation is. It's, I think what Irene was talking about, you know, once it's like there's certain ways that animation can carry an emotion and a feeling that are just beyond words. So at PNCA, we see animation in a very broad way, and that's why we call it animated arts. So it may be installation, it may be film, it may be data visualization, you know, but we just feel like animation is so critical to what the future will be in and the content of screens. And we want people who have something to say to be contributing toward that dialogue.
Well, Rose, it's always a pleasure. Thanks for coming in again.
My pleasure.
And I think we'll go out with a little clip from one of the films that's part of the experimental animation by Latin American women. I want to say that you've been listening to Words and Pictures today. I'm your host, S.W. Conser. I want to thank all of our guests, Irene Taylor Brodsky, Skye Fitzgerald, and Rose Bond. Thanks also to the Oregon Media Production Association for their support and collaboration. And thanks to all our listeners on the radio dial and on the web. The audio for this show will be available later today on our archive page, kboo.fm/wordsandpictures. And you can keep up with us on Twitter at Words and Picture.
Yeah.